Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up today, a look at the resurgent Patriot Movement, but also the hugely successful Boston Marathon charity program. First, European transport officials have just announced the creation of zones across the continent, saying countries can soon begin flying in some of them. Earlier today, Germany granted Lufthansa permission to fly home 50 planes with about 15,000 passengers, and British officials said Scottish airspace will reopen tomorrow. Some relief for travelers stranded by that cloud of volcanic ash from Iceland. Adam Gabbett is with The Guardian in London. Adam, first of all, how were Germany and Britain able to do this? There are other airlines with stranded passengers around the world.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it seems that the volcanoes actually stopped erupting this afternoon. When I say stopped erupting, now lava is coming out, which sounds more dangerous. And if you're near to it, of course it would be. But for planes in the atmosphere, once the lava is actually coming out instead of this volcanic ash, that's actually quite a good sign. So the volcanic ash has stopped coming out. It's stopped drifting down towards mainland Europe and the UK. And it's because of that that they anticipate they'll be able to run most services, certainly in the UK, by tomorrow.
But then there's the issue of the volcano that's a neighbor to the one in Iceland that's been spewing this ash and now the lava. What's the concern about this second volcano?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the second volcano is called Katla. It's a very well-known volcano. And the main problem with that is that when this current volcano, which is spouting now, which I'm not going to try and pronounce, you'll know why if you see the name written down.
I'm doing the same thing.
Well, when this current one has been going off in the past, it has occasionally triggered Katla, which is a much bigger volcano, prone to the same kind of problems because both of these are under glaciers. They melt this ice rather than just spewing out stuff straight into the atmosphere. And that's what kind of is contributing factor to throwing out so much ash. And as I say, Katla's a lot bigger. Indeed, I think the last time these two went off in tandem, they went off for 8 months and are credited, at least in part, with starting the French Revolution.
Oh, my. So officials will keep an eye on that. But meanwhile, we hear that the ash cloud is also shifting. It had been traveling eastward across Europe. Now it's also traveling westward. There are reports of it possibly reaching the eastern coast of Canada later today, and some flights there have already been canceled. What do you know about that shift in the winds, apparently?
Yeah, well, I think this is partly a shift in the wind and partly that it's just taken so long to actually travel over to the west. The way it came down to the UK, it didn't come straight down to the east, southeast, I should say, from Iceland. It went across to the east, then came west from Scandinavia. I think it's to do with the way the Gulf Stream's set up. And I think it's partly that pattern which is still sending over the same ash that may have been lingering over these parts, which is now just finally reaching America. While I can't see it spreading across the whole of the United States, I think you've seen over here the disruption it can cause to a relatively small area. So even if it did just hamper that east coast, obviously there's a lot of air traffic that comes out of there, could cause a lot of disruption.
Well, and what's the sense of how the crisis has been handled? We understand the IATA, the International Air Transport Association, is saying that the European response to the ash cloud has been a, quote, embarrassment and a mess. You've been blogging for days now, communicating with travelers all over the world. Is there a sense that this is an overreaction, or is that the kind of response that you get until there's a terrible accident?
There is a sense, certainly in the business community, that there's been an overreaction. The IATA came out, as you've just said, with some pretty strong remarks today. They said it's taken 5 days to organize a phone conference. I mean, certainly from travelers I've spoken to, no one is too upset because everyone can understand that it's a natural disaster. I mean, no one can control a volcano going off. But I think the business community may just have kind of started a bit of an uprising now with this, and people are starting to think, well, has it been handled that well? It does seem like it's taken a long time, and also the information that's been coming out, it's been a kind of drip feed of information, which has been quite difficult for people to stomach. You know, if people are planning to go on holiday, they haven't known if they'll be able to or not, whether they'll have to book alternative transport or not, because we've been getting information in these kind of 6-hourly updates. But then, I mean, it's a volcano. You can't control a volcano to coincide with a press conference. So I think there's a little bit of both sides.
Meanwhile, as we said, Britain is announcing that flight restrictions over Scottish airspace will be lifted tomorrow morning at 2 a.m. East Coast U.S. time. Other British airports could reopen later tomorrow. And Germany's announced that it's going to have several planes start flying today because they will be flying by visual flight rules. I suppose that means they have to be able to see where they're going.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, any cloud, I think conditions have been particularly clear over Europe all weekend. I think that's one of the quirks of this dust. You know, everyone had been expecting to see sort of black clouds and everything. In London, it's been actually the best weekend of the year so far. But yeah, visual flight rules, as you say, just when you can see. In the UK, the ban is lifted in Scotland and Northern England from, as you say, 2 a.m. East Coast time. Some reports are suggesting it will be lifted for the rest of the UK, so the whole of England, Wales and Scotland, by around 2 p.m. East Coast time. So that would be a big boost. But there's no kind of signs as yet for what the rest of Europe's going to do. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I'd imagine if the UK can clear its skies, then I'm pretty sure Europe will not be too far behind.
Adam Gabbett with The Guardian in London. Adam, thanks so much. A couple of weeks ago, I joined Boston marathoner Barry Chade as he trained along the Charles River here in Boston. Charity runners like Barry, marathoners who run to raise money for a cause, call it doing the Thursdays.
Okay, how far will you run?
Tonight, I'm just going to go out for 30 minutes, about 3 miles, and get ready for that big day.
What happens after the run?
We'll be going back to Crossroads and hanging out together.
Did you run?
Today I did a 26-minute walk run.
The Crossroads Irish Pub, a block from the river, is where charity runners gather on Thursday nights. Laptops and gym bags are piled on bar stools. Work clothes are strewn about. It's a tradition that was brought over from the now-defunct runner's bar, the Elliott Lounge, by bartender J.J. Larner.
What they do is they leave their stuff here, take the train out to Woodland, which is on the course, and run the last 9 miles of the course in. So it's a good training run and gives you a place to regroup afterwards. They're not going to win. They're not going to catch the Kenyans. A lot of them might not have qualified, but they're doing good work. It's a good thing.
They're definitely doing a good thing. In the back of the bar, Betsy Gott stretches on the old wooden floor.
Who are you running for in the marathon?
My aunt Karen and my patient partner at Dana-Farber is Theo. He's 3 years old.
Dana-Farber Cancer Institute fields one of the biggest teams of charity runners, over 500. They'll run in the marathon today for loved ones and for patients they're paired with. But on this Thursday night, they cheer each other on.
How was your run tonight? Are you going to break 3:30, you think?
So we have two more runners who've come in and headed right for the beer pitcher.
It's good for carb loading.
It's a great way to get carbs after a run.
They've actually done studies that show beer is better for recovery than water. Because of the carbs.
The Boston Marathon Charity Program was created almost 22 years ago, partly as a way to corral bandits, runners who didn't run fast enough to qualify but jumped in anyway. The Boston Athletic Association said, okay, we'll let you in, start you in the back of the pack, if you run for a charity. Well, from one charity in 1989, there are now 24, 1,350 official charity runners this year out of 26,000 runners total. And some grumbling that these runners do get in without qualifying.
Hey, man, how are you? This is Tom Tanzi. Yes, Tom Tanzi.
Dave McGilvery had to be one of the first charity runners. Back in the 70s, he ran and organized walks for the Jimmy Fund, an arm of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Now Dave is the Boston Marathon race director, who also famously runs the course after everyone else finishes. We sat down to talk about charity running.
The whole industry has changed. In the 70s and 80s, early 80s, it was all about competition. And now, this year, we'll mark our 22nd year of having charities, and we'll surpass the $100 million mark.
$100 million.
As a result of runners running in the marathon, raising funds for very worthwhile causes.
And just can you think of some?
Well, the most memorable one for me was Katie Lynch. And Katie was a patient at Children's Hospital, and she called me up one day and she says, can I come in and meet with you? I have a question to ask you. I said, sure. When I met her, my jaw dropped because Katie was 26 inches tall. And she had 32 operations at Children's, and she said, can I run the Boston Marathon? And she says, but I have a caveat. I said, what's that? She says, my marathon is 26.2 feet. I do it in my walker. And I said, okay, that's fine. And it was the most memorable moment in the history of the Boston Marathon ever for me, where Katie got out of her wheelchair and walked 26.2 feet from the starting line to a finish line that I'd put on the road. And I gave her a laurel wreath and a medal. And she actually waited for me at the finish line when I finished later on at night, and gave me a medal and gave me a laurel wreath and looked up at me and said, ha, I beat you. But she raised thousands and thousands of dollars for Children's Hospital. And unfortunately, Katie is no longer with us today. But just it is amazing, the euphoria in that charity program. One of the first times I ran the Boston Marathon, I did it to raise money for the Carroll Center for the Blind. My brother had said to me, run the Boston Marathon and raise money. I said, no one's going to give me any money just to run a marathon.
This was back then.
This was back in 1983. Nobody did this. So I ran the Boston Marathon blindfolded and raised $10,000 for the Carroll Center. And I don't know, that might have been one of the very first times anyone ran that race and raised money for a charity. Almost 30 years later, look where we are now.
A side effect of that, Dave McGilvery, you're known nationwide as a soft touch. If someone wants to get into the Boston Marathon, you're nodding. Well, maybe I could just run for a charity, and Dave has such a heart, he'll let me in.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the biggest conundrum in this industry. What you try to do is beat the system a little bit, shut things down a little earlier than you probably need to, and then when you do get the hot throb stories, every now and then you can accept a few here and there.
And it's gotten kind of complicated over the years. There are people who manage the running teams. Tell me a little bit about that.
Charity programs, they're very well organized. They need a team manager. They may need a team coach. They have meetings. They have training runs. They have fundraising functions and parties.
So are they paying out more money than they're raising if they're doing all that?
Absolutely not. The fundraising to expenses off the charts in terms of what they're raising versus what it costs. No, I sort of have this motto that when you give, you receive even more in return.
Well, and it did come back to you. Your youngest, Chloe, was born with a problem, and she ended up at the very hospital that you raised money for.
We went to Children's Hospital a month or so ago, and when we actually handed over our little nine-month-old Chloe to the nurses and walked away, I finally realized what all those families, what they experience, and I couldn't believe it. I looked out the window and I looked down, and there was Jimmy Funway, where I had stood on for years and years and years, looking up at the windows at all the children holding signs.
Because we should say that your race that you used to raise money for the Jimmy Fund, it went right by that window.
Went right by that window, and never once thinking that someday I'd be on the other side of that window. Needing help.
How's Chloe?
She's doing great.
We've been taking a look at the hugely successful Boston Marathon charity program. Copied by other sporting events, it grants time requirement waivers to a certain amount of runners if they run for a charity. In 1989, the program raised about $6,000. Today's race is expected to take in upwards of $14 million. We visited the Crossroads Bar in Boston, where charity runners gathered ahead of today, to see how it works.
What team are you running
for? For Dana-Farber.
Dana-Farber. MS.
We're going to do the Woodland
Runs. Oh, you are?
Yeah. You want to come?
Are you thinking morning or, like, afternoon? Like, how are you going to run this?
10 marriages have been produced by these Thursday night training sessions at the Crossroads. But more important, the charity runners commit to raising a certain amount of money. Sarah Nixon, the mother of three, runs for the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and says after several years, it takes some creativity to convince friends to kick in.
I've done it every single year, and they're like, oh, it's the same old story.
What is the story? Try it out on me.
My story this year? There's a crossing guard in Medfield who's been there for 60 years, and she was diagnosed with cancer and has survived it. She survived the World War II and hiding in the attic. She's just an amazing person. So I asked, could I share her story? And that hit a lot of the Medfield people. They know Mrs. Mann. And then anybody that donates $100, I'm putting them in a raffle, and I'm offering dinner parties, barefoot contested dinner parties. that I'll cook. So you just try to add in fun.
Meanwhile, though, will you be thinking of Mrs. Mann?
Absolutely. There's also a child that I run for, I've done the last 7 years, who died, and it's called the In Memory. And they just don't, they want families to know that their child who lost their battle isn't forgotten. Stetson, I have his name on my back in his picture, but there are other people each year.
So, Sarah, how much do you raise?
My goal is always about $10,000. And over the last 15 years, I've been able to raise $109,000. So.
Wow. Then there's attorney Barry Chait, who runs for the American Liver Foundation.
And my mother died of cancer of the liver, so I felt someone was telling me something. This was my calling. And so for 11 years, I ran it for Zelda. And I said, I'm retiring. And then a friend, very close friend from running, died of pancreatic cancer. And the day before he died, I promised him, I said, we have one more to do, Tim, and I'm going to do it for you. So I've dedicated this to Tim. I'll get there, and I'm projecting somewhere around $45,000 I'm going to raise.
And how to say this, Bear? Very attractive man. But I wouldn't see you coming down the street and say, wow, look at that elite runner.
I'm an elite fundraiser.
Do you think you'd be running if it weren't for this?
Definitely not. And the first time I did it, the bookies took me off the chart. They wouldn't take any more bets because everyone was betting that I would not finish the marathon. And at mile 22, I cramped up, had no feeling in either leg. Tears were coming down my eyes. And then I stood up and I started running again. Zelda.
So Barry is still inspired by his mother, Zelda. Sitting next to him at the crossroads, Tom Kansas, a believer now, but not when he first started.
I just wanted to run the marathon, and I got a number through the Red Liver Foundation. Barry helped me.
Aha, we heard about this. See, some people think that's a way for me to get in.
It is, and so it's like, all right, I raise money. I don't really have any personal connections, but I need a number somehow. I am not fast enough to qualify, God knows. I'm a long way from that, so I'll just raise some money for a charity. Really, I really thought it was going to be a one-and-done exercise for me. Check the box, get on with my life, do other things, but I caught up with the team, the energy, these 250 people wearing orange jerseys that are with the American Liver Foundation. There's hundreds and hundreds of people along the way cheering for you. You almost feel like you have your own personal team and cheering section.
Later, at the now-packed Crossroads Bar, we found Jack Foltz, winner of the 1976 marathon and now coach of the Dana-Farber team. He said when the charity program first started, runners did join just to get in the race, but that's largely changed. Even so, I asked if he sees the runners who join just to get a number changed by the people really running for a cause.
That's a very observant comment. Yeah, we start off with a fairly low fundraising minimum, $3,200, $3,500, something like that. But we average over $8,000 per runner on our Dana-Farber team, and we have 500-plus runners on the team. So it's massive. So we get them in the door, and by the end of the 20-week training program, when the marathon shows up, 99%+ of the people are running really for the cause.
You're a runner. You've won. Do you think that it really makes a difference in the time or even in being able to finish the marathon to know you're running for someone else?
It absolutely does. I mean, I remind them, as they are reminded by many others as well, that this is sort of their Superman cape.
Which brings us back to Barry Chait, mild-mannered lawyer / CPA by day, Superman on marathon day.
One of the runners ran marathon 20 years. He was about to retire, and his secretary came down with liver disease. He ran for Patty Savage, I remember. It's over 10 years ago. Patty's alive today. And he always says, when you're feeling lousy out there, think about Patty, or whatever it may be, a kid in Children's Hospital. Think about them. And boy, it makes it a lot easier. We're the lucky ones.
Pope Benedict XVI is marking his fifth anniversary as leader of the Catholic Church by hosting a luncheon with cardinals, but it's an anniversary clouded by the clergy sex abuse scandal. Yesterday, during a visit to the island of Malta, the Pope met with a group of men who'd been sexually abused by priests as youngsters. The Pope told them the Church will seek justice for pedophile priests and expressed shame and sorrow for the pain the victims suffered. But will the Pope's expression of sympathy be enough to convince European Catholics
to stay with the church. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg has this story from the Pope's home country, Germany.
At the Church of St. Maximilian, bells herald the evening mass. This church is in the Catholic heartland of Germany, Bavaria. 5 years ago, the election of a Bavarian pope was a source of enormous pride here. But the clerical abuse scandal has shaken Bavarians' faith in Pope Benedict and in their church. Rainer Maria Schiesler is the priest at St. Maximilian's.
The Vatican must go to the people and to say, we have made mistakes, it was wrong, it's not good, and we want to make a new beginning with you all.
Hundreds of cases of physical and sexual abuse by priests and monks have been reported in Germany. Some cases in Pope Benedict's former archdiocese of Munich.
My task was to go in this very famous monastery in Bavaria. It's called Ettal, and I found a lot of terrible cases.
Thomas Pfister is a Munich-based lawyer. He was hired by the church to investigate child abuse at a monastery school.
Since 1960 till 1990, there was a lot of physical, sexual abuse against hundreds of children. And a lot of monks made this, yes, we can say, torture. For example, the children had to eat salamanders. The monk who gave these salamanders to eat to the children, he made also a confession. He said, all right, it's true, I apologize for this.
Pope Benedict has apologized to victims of abuse in Ireland, but so far he hasn't spoken about German victims. His silence has sparked anger back home. Christian Weissner is spokesman for the Catholic Reform Movement. We are the Church.
I think it's his home country, and we are really missing a word of the Pope.
But they won't wait forever. Surveys show that 1 in 4 German Catholics is now considering leaving the Church. At the Munich Registry Office, people queue outside room 353. The sign on the door, Church Deregistration. Because all church members in Germany must register with the state and pay a monthly tax, to leave a congregation, you have to fill out a form and get it stamped. Last month, nearly 2,000 people in Munich did that, 3 times more than usual. And most of the visitors we spoke to were leaving the Catholic Church.
I'm very dissatisfied with the recent events and how the church reacted to them. And, I mean, you would also cancel a membership in any other organization if you're not satisfied anymore, wouldn't you?
As I'm a devout Catholic, it's a very difficult decision. However, I will not pay the money for those people who commit these crimes.
Back at St. Maximilian's, the Mass draws to a close. These are uncertain times for the priests and parishioners and for the Vatican. Pope Benedict himself has been accused of covering up cases of clerical abuse. For the first German pope in a millennium, the challenge now is to persuade Catholics in his homeland to remain in his church.
The BBC's Steve Rosenberg reporting from Germany. And a quick reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can download a podcast or hit contact us to send an email or phone us. You can also scroll down and leave a comment about anything on the program right there on the homepage, hereandnow.org. You can also, by the way, find us on XM Public Radio and follow us on Twitter at hereandnow. Before we go today, a look at the so-called Patriot Movement on this Patriot's Day, and we'll have the results of the Boston Marathon. You're listening to Here and Now. April 19th has become the most significant day in the calendar for the so-called Patriot Movement. It's the day the first shots against the British were fired in the Battle of Lexington Concord here in Massachusetts in 1775. It's also the day Timothy McVeigh, fueled by anti-government rage, bombed the federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995, in part to mark the anniversaries of the federal raids in Waco, Texas, and Ruby Ridge, Idaho, a few years earlier. Well, today, gun rights activists chose April 19th to rally in the Capitol at an unarmed march at the Washington Monument and across the Potomac in Virginia, where about 75 activists are carrying guns in a national park, a right, by the way, that was granted them by President Obama. So what does all of this mean? Mark Potok has been tracking the Patriot Movement for the Southern Poverty Law Center in Alabama. He joins us. And, Mark, you recently told us there's been a surge in extremist groups. You call it a second wave. But these groups today have very small turnout. Are you concerned about them?
Well, it's interesting that they have apparently had such small turnouts, because certainly they, in their ranks, were expecting tens of thousands of people, not so much at the Virginia rally as at the D.C. rally. I mean, I am concerned about the ideology that these people are pushing. It's not so much that the particular leaders who will be speaking today in D.C. or in Virginia are people who are going to go out and blow up federal buildings. But they are essentially, or many of them, are promoting a kind of ideology that very much identifies the federal government not merely as too big or pursuing some policy that they disagree with, but as evil, as involved in secret machinations and conspiracies to do things like impose martial law on the country, to set up concentration camps for all who resist.
I think it was Minnesota's Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann who suggested that President Obama was building concentration camps to imprison opponents.
Yeah, well, what she said in part was that she thought that the president was building political re-education camps for our children all around the country, and that these were presumably for the purpose, of turning our children into little Marxist robots.
So it's the language and the ideology, maybe not the people, but some of the same people and some of the same groups are involved in both of today's guns rights rallies. One group is Oath Keepers. Now, this is a group of former and active military and police officials. And then there's Larry Pratt, who leads the group Gun Owners of America. And he goes back to the birth of the modern militia movement in the 90s. Remind us.
Larry Pratt was very much at the center of the militia movement back in the 1990s, and he has reappeared. He is essentially leads a group that is a very radical version of the National Rifle Association. He also participated in a meeting way back in 1992, which was a seminal meeting for organizing the initial Patriot Movement. That meeting, in fact, was run and called by a white supremacist pastor in Colorado.
Well, in fact, you point out that this Patriot Movement, so-called Patriot Movement, was really out of favor for a while, particularly post 9/11, when people became more concerned about threats against the government. Why do you think it's now resurgent, or in your mind, a second wave of a Patriot Movement?
Well, I think a number of things have come together. On the one hand, there is a lot of angst among certain people, certain portion of the population, about the changing racial demographics of this country. The idea that by the year 2050, as the Census Bureau has predicted, whites will lose their majority. And that, of course, is all personified in the person of Barack Obama, a black man in the White House.
And you know that many people protesting today about gun rights or protesting bank bailouts would be very offended by that. They would say that race has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, and what I would say in rejoinder is that is certainly true for a great many of them. But I don't think that there's any doubt that there are streaks of racism that run through this movement, through the Tea Party movement, through the various Second Amendment groups, and so on. But to continue, I think the second broad set of factors have to do with the economy, the pain and anger and frustration that people are feeling, particularly unemployed people, but also anger over things like the bailouts, which to many people look like the government aiding, a bunch of auto and banking and mortgage executives while sort of the common people get nothing. It seems to me that the third major driver of this really has been the role of certain ostensibly mainstream politicians and commentators who very much, along the lines of Michelle Bachmann, have been feeding the flames, and typically with propaganda or conspiracy theories that are utterly false, but nevertheless are presented as fact to millions of Americans.
Well, what are you concerned about? Some would say, look, there's always going to be time spasms in American history where people rise up and protest the government. People doing it today might point to the Vietnam era protesters. But then we're also reading that some conservative activists and lawmakers in Oklahoma are pushing for the formation of an Oklahoma militia. They want it to be an armed volunteer force that would somehow, it's not clear, fight unpopular federal initiatives. Your thoughts?
Well, what I think about protest in general is it's absolutely true that through our history we've gone through periods of backlash or real anger over things that are developing, and typically this happens at times when the society's going through some major changes. Certainly that was occurring in the 90s. You know, we saw similar things around, you know, when slaves were freed, when women got the right to vote, or when the gay rights movement really got rolling, and so on, the civil rights movement. The Oklahoma events, the proposal in Oklahoma is really pretty far out there. I mean, basically there are some Tea Party people teaming up with some legislators who are interested in creating a militia specifically for the purpose of resisting federal mandates, such as health care. You know, that is, in fact, a perfectly legal thing to do in terms of the Constitution. But look, the reality is that these kinds of questions were settled at Gettysburg. They were settled at Little Rock. I mean, you know, one wonders, is this Oklahoma militia going to surround the hospitals with armed National Guardsmen or militiamen the way Orville Faubus did Central High School in Arkansas on Little Rock? Seems a very worrying kind of idea.
Well, I was going to ask, is it a worrying idea, or will it be some weird, quirky sidebar, you know, in history books? Is it worrying you?
Well, presumably it will probably go away. It's certainly the reaction to it has not been very favorable. I think it's worth saying that, you know, one of the promoters of this idea in Oklahoma is a state representative by the name of Charles Key. You know, Charles Key was a guy back in the 1990s who always felt that the Oklahoma City bombing was a conspiracy, and he really suggested in so many words, as many in the Patriot world did, that it was the work of the government, of the Clinton administration. He convened a grand jury to look into the supposed conspiracy. Ultimately, the grand jury came out and said, no, there was no conspiracy, at which point Charles Key held a news conference to denounce his own grand jury.
Mark Potok, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, checking in with us on the so-called Patriot Movement. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Runners from all over the world are still outrunning the Boston Marathon. Here in Boston, where we are, here and now is Alex Ashlock, joins us from the finish line in the Back Bay. And Alex, you know, some years it's very dramatic. Some years the winners, you know, are shoo-in. So sum it up for us this year.
Well, this year, Robin, the women's race was close again. You might remember, I'm sure you remember last year, it was the closest finish ever in the women's race. Not quite as close today, but a first-time Boston marathoner, first time here running the race, Teba Erkeso of Ethiopia, edged Tatiana Pushkareva of Russia in the women's race by about 3 or 4 seconds. They came down Boylston Street running together, but Erkeso, who really had the lead for the last several miles of the race, Pushkareva trying to catch her, but she couldn't quite do it. So it was another close finish on the women's side.
Which is so exciting to watch. What about the men's race?
The men's race, Robert Chariot, Boston Marathon fans know that name. This is not the Robert Chariot that won this race 4 times. This is a different Kenyan runner who is not related to Robert Chariot, but he has the same name. He smashed the course record today, ironically held by Robert Chariot, the other Robert Chariot.
Oh, that's going to be confusing.
It is confusing, and what's even more confusing is their middle initials are both K. But the winner today is Robert Caprono Chariot. He ran 2:05:52. That's 2 hours, 5 minutes, and 52 seconds. He just obliterated the other Robert Chariot's course record, which was 2 hours, 7 minutes, and 14 seconds. He broke away in the Heartbreak Hill area of the race and just won very, very easily.
Well, we know that American Ryan Hall took fourth, and people thought that there might be an American winning, but that still was the fastest time ever by an American for Ryan Hall.
Yeah, it's a great race for him. He finished third here last year. Of course, he wanted to win the race. But he fell back early in the race after leading at the very beginning. And I'm not sure why that was, but he did recover, and he finished fourth. And another American, Mebka Flesgi, finished fifth in the race. Both of those guys had third place finishes from earlier trips to Boston.
Well, tell us about the women's wheelchair winner.
The women's wheelchair winner, Wakako Toshida of Japan, she's come to dominate this race. This was her fourth straight win in the wheelchair race. Wheelchair races here at Boston. She's approaching Jean Driscoll territory. Jean Driscoll had eight titles in the women's wheelchair race.
And in the men's division.
The men's division, Ernst Van Dijk, amazing athlete, this gentleman. He's won nine Boston marathons now, the most by any competitor in any division. He had to do it in the last 800 meters of the race today. He edged out Krieg Shabor, who is a U.S. citizen now, but also was originally from South Africa, as Ernst Van Dijk is. Those two gentlemen are longtime friends, longtime competitors. Van Dijk edged him out in the last few meters of the race, and he won his ninth title.
Oh, again, so another nail biter. Alex Ashlock at the finish line of the Boston Marathon with the winners in the three top categories. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And Alex left us with another report on Lisa Rainsberger. Now, Lisa was the last American woman to win this race back in 1985. She was one of the top American runners in those days, an alternate on three Olympic teams. She later won the Chicago Marathon twice. And she told Alex that today's anniversary run will be extra special because she's running with her husband and her daughter.
I think the special part for me is my family's here. You know, they had to suffer through a lot of this when I was competing, and now to 25 years later to come back and reflect and have them share it with me, it just makes it very special.
Now, the story of how you came to running is interesting. Tell us that story.
Well, I was a competitive swimmer. You know, I swam my whole childhood, went to Michigan on a swimming scholarship. And in 1980, I had qualified for the Olympic trials, but it was also the year we boycotted. And so rather than stay home and, you know, beat myself up in the swimming pool, I took the summer off of swimming and went to Wyoming for a biology course that Michigan was offering at the time. And I tell the story where I discovered beer and boys and gained 15 pounds. And so I quickly had to get back in shape for my sophomore year in the swimming pool. And I fell in love with running. And, you know, the rest is history.
And you said it came easily to you. Well, almost embarrassingly, you said it came easily.
You know, I am embarrassed about how easy the switchover for me was. And I think the swimming had created the engine. And I just had to fine-tune, you know, into a new sport. And the work ethic was there, and I think swimmers, they are the hardest working people there exists. And so I had developed that as a young child. And so for me to switch to running, it was just developing the muscle structure, and the engine was already there. So it did come easy. It came quick, and I, you know, was an All-American after the first year of running at Michigan and qualified for the Olympic trials the year after that, and life was good.
When you came to Boston in 1985, had that been a goal to come and run this race?
Well, as an athlete, I think we all look at the Boston Marathon as the pinnacle in the sport. And so, yes, it was something that I wanted very much.
And I read you stayed with a family out in Hopkinton the night before the race, and you don't even know who they were?
No, I wish I could, you know, reconnect with them. They were gracious. They opened up their home, and I spent the night, and I, you know, woke up in the morning, and they were already gone volunteering for the race, and I had the whole house to myself, and I made myself a little breakfast and walked to the starting line all by myself. And it was, you know, looking back, I was, you know, I had to be a little bit brave because, you know, at age 23 in a strange house in a strange city and, you know, to run a marathon and then to, you know, to win was, oh boy, I don't know if I could do that again.
What did winning that particular race, the Boston Marathon, this particular race, what did it mean to you long term in your career?
It validated me. It really did. It validated me as a professional female runner and gave me credibility to add to my resume. I think, you know, other races in the world are great, but Boston, people understand it. And so with the history behind it, the 100-plus years it's been being run, and to win it, it put me in a very elite crowd of women runners.
And how often have you come back since 1985?
I come back every 5 years. It's an anniversary. And this year I brought my family. And like I said, our oldest daughter's going to run with us. And so I try to make it a point of coming back every 5 years.
You won Chicago twice, I believe. And you mentioned already the Olympic trials. How do you think about the finishing fourth in three Olympic trials and being an alternate and not getting to run in the Olympic Games?
Well, it kept me from putting a period at the end of the sentence. And so I do feel it's unfinished for me. But it doesn't define my entire career. It's just, it's a nice, unfortunate statistic. I had a great long career, 15 plus years of being a professional woman athlete and traveling the world and, meeting my husband through the sport. And now I give back. I coach a kids' trail running series. I coach other athletes trying to make the Olympic team. I've had a woman win a bronze medal in the sport of triathlon that I coach. So I still am receiving a lot, even though I don't have the Olympic uniform.
You've had a great career. Thanks for speaking with
me. Thank you. Appreciate it.